This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 167, The Tale of Three Vipers. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is John Mills. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Paramount's decision to dump Orci, the campaign for Frakes to direct the next film, plus we debate which series made the best use of the holodeck, and share some news about the future of The Ready Room. Then in the feature, we're joined by Norm Lau to discuss the DS9 episode, Destiny. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, John. It's great to have you back here with me on the Ready Room. This is the first Ready Room that I recorded in about a month. There have been some huge changes in my life which are affecting my ability to podcast and will continue to do so. I'll tell everyone about that at the end of the show, so stay tuned to that. But John, how have things been going for you?
Things have been going very well. Thank you for asking. I am pleased to be one of the new co-hosts on Commentary Trek Stars and having a great time appearing with Mike and Max over there. So thank you for welcoming me to a more permanent role on the network. Thanks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's great to have you on there. And are you keeping Max under control? I know he can be a little bit difficult sometimes.
I have yet to encounter anybody that makes me laugh quite as much as Max does.
I love listening to Max on Commentary Trek Stars myself. All right. Well, one of the changes happening with the Ready Room because of what's happening in my life is that the show is going to be a little bit shorter than it used to be. And our news segment is going to be a little bit shorter. So we have two things to talk about today. And the first one, John, I'm really interested in hearing your thoughts on this. This is the news that's been swirling around the past few weeks about Star Trek 3 or Star Trek 2016. The fact that Paramount has dumped Orci as the director. There are a number of names swirling around. And also, there's been a campaign to get Frakes, Jonathan Frakes, in the director's chair. And he said he would love to do it. I don't know if Paramount will go for it. I personally think it would be great for Star Trek fans. But what are your thoughts on everything that's been happening?
Well, first and foremost, I want to say that I think your instincts are correct about Frakes. I think that Frakes would be a huge get for fans. It would make all of us feel would give us all the warm and fuzzies that we want. And we would feel, in a sense, that he would be getting a redemption shot after maybe a questionable script for Insurrection that he tried to spin silk out of, but there's only so much you can do. And we all definitely regard First Contact as good. He is an accomplished television director. I feel that he's grown since. I think he's a quality choice for a number of reasons, but I think that fans should just, that ship is not ever going to come into port. And we just have to be comfortable with that.
Okay, so you think Paramount will never hire Frakes to direct this film?
No, I don't. I think I will stake what few quatloos I have on it that there is a 0% chance they'll go with Frakes.
Well, I'm curious. Do you think that is because of his connection to past Star Trek and J.J. Abrams not wanting a connection to that? Do you think it's because he's too old? What would be a reason for that?
I think it is because Paramount is going to want a name that is going to excite and titillate the non-Trek public as well. Okay. Abrams got everybody interested that wasn't a Trek fan. If they go to Frakes, that gets Trek fans excited, but that does not get other people excited. It's like, you know, casting Affleck as Batman. You know, the fans will learn to accept it, and they're still going to see the movie anyway, but Affleck might get a few extra butts in the seats.
Yeah, I can see that. I saw this tweet go by about a story, and I didn't read the story, so I don't know if this is actually in any way a true rumor or not, but it was about them trying to get George Lucas to direct the Star Trek movie. And I thought, that's crazy. I certainly don't ever want to see that happen. And it's not because of a Star Wars thing. It's just, I don't think George Lucas would be a good choice for directing a film.
No, I don't think that he wouldn't, you know, maybe I'm too dismissive because he did create THX-1138, which was some pretty hardcore out there science fiction.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think that Lucas's storytelling style lends itself to Star Trek as much as you can make the argument that Star Wars' success influenced how Paramount approached and structured certain aspects of the Trek franchise. He's a less than 0% chance.
I don't think there was anything about, but it was interesting to see it go by.
Yeah.
Well, while we're talking about directors, let's talk about some of the names that are out there. Reports are, according to a piece on TrekMovie.com, that Rupert Wyatt from Rise of the Planet of the Apes is the leading contender to replace Orsi. What are your thoughts on that?
It would be a good choice. You know, he's obviously comfortable with handling effects. He's obviously able to get good performances out of actors in an effects-heavy environment and can tell a story effectively. That was a good movie. It really was. And I remember being wowed by it, you know, going in with middling expectations and then at the end of it saying, well, this guy knew how to put a movie together. And, you know, I think you can't underestimate that. You know, somebody that's able to work on something fairly big budget and also has a bit of non-Trek cachet that he can bring in with him, that's, you know, it's a good choice.
Do you think you might sneak a few apes into the movie?
Well, depending on your point of view, they're all apes in the movie, Chris. So
that's true. What if, because I understand, at least this is the word, that the studio had issues with the script and that's one reason why they got rid of Orsi. If they are going to go with a completely new script, maybe an adaptation of the comic book series, the Star Trek Planet of the Apes IDW comic book series could be in the works, and then maybe Wyatt would be a good choice for that.
How thrilling would that be? How absolutely thrilling would that be? I would expect that the internet comment forums would be completely silent about that too.
Well, we already know what the name of the film would be. It would be Star Trek The Primate Directive, like the comic book is.
I mean, they've basically got a script to, you know, that they can already go off of. It shortens the pre-production time.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see. So speaking of the script, I guess we should share our thoughts on what the rumors are of the script, which was that it had to do with time travel and them going back to prevent Vulcan from being destroyed in the first place. And that's where the whole William Shatner thing came in, so that Nimoy and Shatner could play the older versions and work together with the younger Quinto and Pine. What do you think about that story if they had made it?
If they had made it, that would have... It's difficult because a part of me would say, you know, it's Star Trek. I've been with them through good and bad. That plot, if it's true that they canned them because of that plot line, then in a sense, bully for them, because there's nothing about that plot line that I want to see made. The time travel thing, the callbacks, this is supposed to be the fresh beginning, as it were.
Right.
And I think we've all been forgiving enough. Stop referencing the old stuff. Let's move forward. Let's just keep going.
Yeah, I agree there. And, you know, he was promising that it was going to be a 5-year mission. And that's not really a 5-year mission, right? That's going back once again to try to correct something that you did in an earlier film. So, yeah, I was not very interested in that either. And I'm very much on record as saying that I did not want William Shatner to be in that movie. I love William Shatner, but I don't need him to make a cameo in the next Star Trek film. So what about with directors? There are a few other names on the list. Martin Tyldum from The Imitation Game, Daniel Espinosa, Justin Lin, Duncan Jones. Do any of those excite you? Is there someone else who isn't on this list that you would love to see direct the film?
No, well, I mean, my default answer to that question is always Christopher Nolan. You know,
okay.
Who do you want to direct? I mean, you know, no chance it's going to happen.
But if it did, I mean, can you imagine the excitement that might generate in the general public?
Are you kidding?
Coming into that, yeah.
Yeah, that would be...
If that's what they're going for, that could be a good move.
Yeah, if they go for excitement, I mean, Rupert Wyatt doesn't carry, you know, that type of impact as a name, but, you know, known quantity, all of that type of stuff. But like, if they go for this guy, Morton Tyldum, it will purely be because of Oscar buzz. And it gets back to, and I think I've said this elsewhere, but it would get back to Paramount getting somebody that has Oscar buzz and sort of looking over at Disney and saying, well, we didn't want your silly Abrams anyway. We've got an Oscar director over here directing our science fiction franchise. But whoever they pick could easily indicate what direction they want to go in. If they get Lin, I see that in a sense of them just fully embracing action movie mode.
Yeah.
And just pursuing that whole hog.
Because he did the Fast and Furious.
Yeah.
Which people, you know, would be familiar with. And yeah, and that worries me a little bit, because I already think that Into Darkness was too much on the action side for what I personally want out of Star Trek.
Yeah.
So I don't want to go any further to that extreme.
I agree. I you know, it would be nice to see Trek stay a little cerebral for this next go round, or at least focus on the theme as opposed to, oh, well, we have a big ship and now we have an even bigger ship. And now there's going to be an even, you know, let's not get into Star Wars, you know, scale weapons battles.
There's always a bigger fish. Well, I guess last question on this, and then let's move on to the next story. It's almost 2015. This movie's supposed to come out in 2016, probably summer. Are you a little bit worried that they apparently don't have a script and they don't have a director?
Very. I don't see how you could possibly turn around an effects-heavy film, because this undoubtedly will be.
Yeah.
You know, unless maybe there is some sort of prevailing wisdom over there where they say, let's not go for the overblown, you know, effects battle movie. Maybe that would be an indication, if they can turn it around, where they are going to keep it smaller and more dramatic. That could be good.
Maybe. I have trouble seeing them do that, but maybe they will. I would certainly like to see them keep it that way. All right. Well, we'll see what happens. And the other story we have to talk about right now is a poll on StarTrek.com, which we like to talk about here on the Ready Room. This one asks, the Star Trek series that made the best use of the holodeck was? They had over 14,000 fans voting in this. So, John, tell us what the results were.
Well, the results were coming in clear. Number one was The Next Generation with 48%, followed by Voyager with 35%. Deep Space Nine with 13%, Animated Series with 2%, and Enterprise with 2%.
Yeah, a lot of Star Trek fans don't realize that the Animated Series is actually where the holodeck originates before it became an actual part of the storytelling on TNG. So I was kind of glad to see that in there. Enterprise, I mean, there's the Zerillian ship, which has a holodeck, so we get to see some holodeck right there. And then there's the whole last episode of The Next Generation that they tacked onto the end of Enterprise, where Riker uses the holodeck to observe the events of Archer's time period. And that's the still shot that they have on the StarTrek.com website for Enterprise in this poll. So this one was interesting to me because it's pretty much a two-horse race, right? TNG and Voyager. DS9, yeah, they have holodeck thing here and there, but it's not a holodeck show. They have Quark's Hollow Suites, but still, it's usually like we see it snippets, or we see people coming in and out of the holosuites, right? We don't spend a lot of time having a TNG or a Voyager-style adventure, with the exception of maybe like Our Man Bashir,
right?
Bada Bing, Bada Bang, you know, sometimes when we're in VIX. But really, for the purpose of this poll and what they're talking about, it feels like it's TNG to Voyager. So what do you think is the differentiating factor here between those two series?
I mean, you know, The Next Generation, I think, just owns the holodeck because of the Moriarty. You know, when Moriarty escapes,
okay, boom,
there you go. And they use the holodeck very smartly a lot of times, you know, up to and including, like, I start to think of these holodeck programs, and I think of when Data went in there, when he was trying to recreate the emotional effect that Lore had, you know, had triggered with him with the Borg attack, and watching him go through that, and it was just such an, they just made such a point of such an interesting use of it once they moved forward. And, you know, you have the Robin Hood episode. You know, yeah, Voyager used it, but Next Generation, there are so many just classic episodes that they had that hinge on that holodeck. For me, it's just a clear winner.
Yeah, and don't forget about Minuet.
Ah, yes. Yes.
But, you know, one of my favorite TNG episodes, which I know it's not a fan favorite, but I really enjoy it, is Emergence, right at the end of the series, which takes place on the holodeck. And I thought it was very clever, again, because it's at the end of the series, that they're taking elements of all these different programs and throwing them together. And like the ship is freaking out. It all takes place on the holodeck. It's just fun. And it's something that you couldn't really tell without the holodeck.
Yeah, good point.
The other thing with TNG and Voyager is that because the premise of TNG was very much like the original series, where we're just going to go around to different planets, you need some other tool to tell stories to keep the show interesting. But TNG, it was even more challenging than the original series, because in the TNG time period, the Alpha Quadrant, and I guess we should also say the Beta Quadrant because of the Klingons and the Romulans, had become very compressed, and the diplomatic relations were so much more evolved, and it didn't feel like a Wild West scenario like it did for Kirk. It felt more like we're trying to keep the Empire together at this point. You know, we're going to fly around, we're going to ferry diplomats and all. So the show could get kind of boring if that's what you were doing every single week. But by having the holodeck, they were able to tell these really interesting stories that you could do things like, we'll always have Paris. You know, we can tell stories that have nothing to do with space, and we can justify it. With Voyager, they did that a bit, and there are some good episodes with the holodeck and Voyager as well. But the premise of the series is such that Voyager could have told an extremely compelling story from start to finish without the use of the holodeck, because of the challenges that they were facing. They weren't simply going around from place to place that was already familiar to them. So for me, that's a differentiating factor between TNG and Voyager here, and why I would also place TNG very firmly in the first position. Although, what's your favorite of all the holodeck from all the series? What's your favorite holodeck program? Because for me, actual program, not story, it would probably be VIX from DS9.
Yeah, I'd have to give it to VIX. And that, you know, and just to tack on at the end there, Deep Space Nine is in the conversation because they used scenarios like VIX specifically to great effect for the greater arc. Like Next Generation, the holodeck, those were one-off episodes, whereas whenever they use it in Deep Space Nine, it specifically had to do with the plot, including playing a baseball game against the Vulcans.
Oh, yeah, 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 absolutely. All right, well, that's everything that we have in use for this week, so let's go ahead and jump into the feature, and we're going to talk about Destiny.
All right.
Thank you. When Sisko first arrived at Bajoran Emissary, he learned that he was viewed by the Bajorans as a religious icon. It took him a while to warm up to that, but in the third season episode Destiny, three Cardassians come to the station as part of a scientific cooperation between the Federation and the Cardassians and the Bajorans. Well, this former Vedic shows up and says that it's a prophecy about to come true, and it sets into motion a very interesting series of events for Sisko and Kira. And today we're going to talk about this episode, Destiny, and to help us do that, we have with us our very own host of Warp 5 and frequent guest on the 602 Club, Norm Lau. Hey, Norm.
Hey, Chris. How are you doing?
Doing great. Great to have you here on the Ready Room. Now, you've told me that you're sort of a kind of a new Niner. You've seen all of Deep Space Nine, but it's not burned into your brain the way it is maybe for John and me here. So let's hop into some initial thoughts, and I'm going to let you kick it off with your initial thoughts of Destiny, watching it for probably, what, maybe the second time?
Yeah, I'd say the second time. I think that the soft opening or the cold opening was really funny because I'm pretty much sold on anything that Quark says, Armin Shimmerman says.
Yeah.
The one thing that struck me probably more than anything else about this episode was how strong it was based in faith. I wasn't really expecting that because, again, it's Deep Space Nine, it's Star Trek. There's a certain kind of expectation for the storytelling, but and usually it's pretty balanced out between action, plot, dialogue, character development. But really, there's a lot of faith being tested in this. Faith for Sisko, faith for Kira. And I just thought that was a little refreshing and a little bit unexpected because, again, it's something that I haven't been used to seeing in Star Trek over the course of the different series that I've been watching, especially Enterprise, since I've been pretty much heavily invested in watching that again. So I would say that, yeah, faith, and I'm probably going to get in super trouble for saying this with the Niners, but these are my least favorite uniforms of all time. The turtleneck, the blue turtleneck. So
yeah,
I just have to get that out there. I have to get that off my chest. Sorry.
Well, you know, as Niners, we consider these to be the Voyager uniforms.
Yes.
You know, ours are okay. are the ones with the gray on the top.
Right.
The first contact era uniforms. Yeah. It's an interesting thing that you say there because, of course, we think about DS9 as centering so much around faith and the Bajoran religion. But John, would you agree that at this point, even though this is getting us pretty much right in the middle, maybe slightly past the middle of season three, up to this point, we haven't been getting that many stories that center on the faith. We have been getting a lot more standalone episodes and still a little bit of a TNG flavor in the storytelling.
Yeah, I think that this is the point. If you want to point to it, this is the episode that you can see them committing to what's going to become the mythology of all of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And this is a full commitment episode where they've toyed around with it and Sisko's the emissary, doesn't really believe it. But this is the one where I really feel like the show creators and the producers go for broke. They say, you know what? This is it. This is the path we're going on with this character and we're going to absolutely commit to this. And I mean, for me, this is the type of stuff that got me truly, really deeply hooked with Deep Space Nine. And it's specifically because, to speak to your point, Norm, it's because it isn't what you expect with Star Trek. And even with later series that they didn't imitate, like, this is what makes this series unique.
Yeah, you know, it will be, I feel like this episode is sort of forgotten, even amongst Niners. I mean, if you say Destiny, you think, okay, well, what was Destiny? Oh, it's the one with the comet and the three Cardassian women come aboard, right? But it is sort of a linchpin for me because I think it'll be two entire seasons virtually. This is the 15th episode of season three. Rapture is the 10th episode of season five. Rapture is an episode that, of course, all Niners know, everyone remembers, because it's where Sisko himself goes all in on prophecy, and he actually finds the hidden city of Valhalla. But this sets him on that course, and they don't go full in with the storytelling with religion and faith after this, you know, we get some here and there, of course, and it builds, but we also get a lot of other episodes that have nothing to do with it. In the beginning of season four, of course, we have The Way of the Warrior, which is all Worf and the Klingons, but this is a very important episode, I think, for setting things into motion.
I think it points the compass. I know the entire series wasn't just about this thread afterward, but this is definitely the guidepost for them. Like you said, the without this, he doesn't get pointed to Rapture.
Exactly. So Norm, a question for you, thinking about the Next Generation and the Cardassians that we knew there and the Cardassians that we know up to this point in Deep Space Nine, we get to see an interesting angle on the Cardassians here by having scientists come aboard. You know, one of my criticisms of how Klingons are written in Star Trek is that I don't think we see enough of the diversity within the society. I feel like even at this point in DS9, they've done more with the Cardassians to flesh them out than they did with the Klingons all the way up to this point. What did you think about seeing this angle of Cardassians, first of all, scientists, and then, of course, they spin it that on Cardassia, science is really the realm of women and that men don't have a head for science?
Well, again, being newer to watching the show again, I thought it was pretty refreshing seeing two female characters playing the scientists, because what they were doing, this joint endeavor with Starfleet, building this antenna to be able to bounce signal back from the wormhole, that's a pretty huge step. And especially this was what something new, this type of relationship that's being built was something that's on pretty fertile ground, because there's this peace that's not really a peace yet, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
There's a treaty in place, but it's pretty much on paper. That's not really in sentiment. And you can feel that. So when the two scientists came on board, there's still a little bit of kind of like tricky footing there. They're welcome, but they're not welcome. There's a little bit of distrust in the air, but I think that Sisko's trying to do his best to put his best Starfleet foot forward and welcome him to the station. I think that it was neat seeing Kira being a little off put by their compliments to her, because again, you have the Cardassian Bajoran relationship, and yeah, everything looks good on the surface. The peace looks good on the surface, but there is still a little bit of distrust there. And of course, obviously that was pretty well misplaced trust because of the Obsidian Order element towards the end.
Yeah.
But I thought it was neat. I thought it was neat that that they brought in two female scientists as in something that's so important both to the technology and to the building of this peaceful relationship.
In a sense, I'm trying to remember, my old memory is failing, but at this point in true Earth history, weren't the scientific and space exploration programs of the former Soviet Union and America starting to try to work together on a couple of things? So I think
this would have been 95. So
95, yeah,
there was more cooperation. You know, that was just a few years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so there was still this promise of like, maybe we'll be able to work together.
So maybe they were, I mean, because it's very easy to view that Bajoran Cardassian thing, you know, through many different lenses, but maybe they were taking a nod, you know, to the real life situation of the scientists, you know, framing it as, even in the real world, it was the scientists that were going to form that first bridge of societies being able to work together, because they're interested in something factual, you know, with an end, you know, measurable end result. There's no real agenda in a scientific experiment. It's just, you know, something that has a beginning, middle, and end, and you can objectively agree on its outcome. So maybe that's a message that they snuck in somewhere along the way.
And I think that's sort of universal too. I mean, even today you can see, well, if you look at what's going on with the United States and much of the rest of Europe and Russia right now, there's still scientific cooperation between the US and Russia behind the scenes. So I think regardless of what era we're in, science is that thing that allows people to come together from different countries and different cultures that may be in conflict on some level with one another, but that's sort of the common ground where we can bring things together. So it makes perfect sense that this scientific experiment would be that first step for the Cardassians and the Bajorans in particular, and then the Cardassians and the Federation to come together.
Well, the way I saw it was you have science, which has no, it doesn't have a political affiliation. It doesn't have a religious affiliation. It has its own agenda, if agenda is the right word. But I think what they're trying to do, or they were trying to do with this particular part of the story, was to show that without the politics and without the religion, all of these humanoids were trying to come together and do something positive. They were trying to build a bridge using science, using facts, something that can't be really disputed, to do something that hasn't been done before. And it's unprecedented in the realm of the wormhole, trying to build this signal that goes through the wormhole. So it was neat that they were focused on this. And it's unfortunate that the outlying forces that were involved were pretty much getting in the way of their progress. And those were the agendas that I think Odo was trying to get to when he says all humanoids have agendas, whether they know it or not.
It's also interesting that the two forces working against them were the politics and the religion.
Right.
Because that's how it is in everyday life, right? It's always these two extremes that are, or these two agendas anyway, that sort of, you know, shift life for everyone. When they're sitting in, they're having their staff. I love they have staff meetings here too, because, you know, we still got this old TNG feel going a little bit where Sisko calls a staff meeting. But when they're in the staff meeting, and the Cardassian scientist is getting really irritated with O'Brien, did you initially take that as sort of the hostility, knowing that O'Brien himself really does not like Cardassians, and also the Cardassians don't like the humans so much, that it was that kind of tension? But then later we find out that actually it was the Cardassian scientist getting a little bit turned on.
Yeah, sexual tension is, you know, that's a, you know, who could possibly not be attracted to Miles O'Brien? I mean, the guy's got swagger, he's got the looks, and he's got the sense of humor. I mean, the guy's a total package. Come on.
I like how they slipped in, or Tracy Scoggins' character slipped in, the Terek Noir reference, because everyone bristled when she brought that up, because obviously there was that changeover from Terek Noir to Deep Space Nine. That's nothing new to Niners. But it was interesting, again, for me watching it for the second time around, that it still brought, that name still brought a certain level of, I don't know, is bigotry the right word, or prejudice? When it's said, because it's said by a Cardassian on a former Cardassian station in front of all of these people who basically, essentially, don't really have the right to it, but they have the right to it. Am I seeing that differently than everyone else? Because it's not really, I mean, it's theirs, but it's not theirs.
I don't know. I took it as, these are scientists. They're not diplomats. They're not politicians. So they're not thinking so much about how they phrase things. And to them, it was always Terok Nur. You know, I mean, there are shops around where, you know, near me, there's a really big shop chain in Japan, which is now called Aeon, but it used to be called Jasco. We always call it Jasco, and I will always, I'm never going to call it anything else, because that's what I know it as. And I think that that applies, you know, to city names as well, and to all sorts of things in our lives, where, especially if it's part of our culture, which really the station is part of the Cardassian culture, it just happens to be currently operated by Starfleet and the Bajorans. And so I felt like that was maybe more of her just, that's what it is to her, and she says it, and she immediately realizes, oh, that was the wrong thing to say. Whereas if she had been a politician, she would have been very careful about making sure she said the right thing.
But I thought it was a smart piece of writing, because of what they were doing there. They're trying to make this bridge, this negotiation for peace with sharing this technology. But it's still at the surface of everyone's subconscious.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they still kind of like, you know, they still feel that tension. And so, you know, again, with the peace treaty, it's not really there. It is there, but it's not there.
Yeah, that's certainly the intention of the writing, I'm certain. I like to think of it on the other level just because I feel like, personally, in the writing, like it's a little bit too much on the nose to have her say it in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I like to think of it more in terms of what was probably going through her mind in a real world. That helps me feel like the writing is maybe not quite as much on the nose, unnecessarily so there. Mm. Well, what do you guys think if this had worked out, if the Obsidian Order had not shoved its nose into what was going on and caused these problems, and the Bajorans and the Federation and the Cardassians had started to work together more on scientific endeavors? I mean, can you imagine how the series might have played out? It would have been a very different show.
It would have been less interesting in my
definitely.
In my opinion.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. There definitely wouldn't have been some of the best plot lines ever. It's a frightening concept to me to think that it would have worked out. No, bad. That would have felt, I don't know, dishonest to the spirit of the show to me. It really would have. Like, Next Generation, that's the show where something like that works out. Even Voyager or Enterprise. This is not the show where, you know, it's rainbows and unicorns at the end. That doesn't happen here.
Yeah, or as Matthew, of course, my co-host on The Orb, once said, it's not all puppies and horns.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely true. But of course, we look at it that way now after having seen the whole series. But, you know, who knows what direction. I don't think the series would have been as popular or would have endured as it has, and would be viewed probably as being even more relevant today than it was at the time it was written, if it had followed that path. So maybe we have Vedic Yarka and the Obsidian Order to thank for all the wonderful stories that we get later on.
Well, again, from a cursory observation, it always seems that no matter how good the intentions are, these forces were always in play from the very beginning. So no matter how successful this joint venture would have been, somewhere along the line, either the religious order, the Bajorans, or the political aspects of the Cardassians trying to dismantle the peace treaty would have manifested itself in some way, whether it was the Obsidian Order or whether it was sending some type of ship to destroy this communications array and blame it on someone else. Yeah. Maybe that would have happened. It just seems like that's the way that it goes in Deep Space Nine.
You sound like a prophet. You sound like you've seen the past, present, and future.
the one thing I'll toss out there, though, because we have mentioned sort of like the different agendas that acted from, you know, externally, is that the main religion, the main institutional branch of Bajoran religion was okay with the plan, had seen the prophecy that the Vedic had talked about and said, not a big deal. Everything's going to work out fine. And it was, I think that even more importantly than just looking at it from sort of the political as an external and the religious as an external, is looking at, and to speak also to the presence of Cardassian society having scientists and being a little bit better fleshed out than some of the other alien races that we've even known for longer in different Star Trek series, is they don't portray the Bajoran religion as homogeneous. There are different branches and sects, and I think that's really those sorts of attention to detail matters that really makes Deep Space Nine come to life for me, is the fact that it's not you are Cardassians and therefore you are this, you are Bajorans and therefore you all believe this. It's there are shades of belief and shades of understanding of everybody. And I just think that this episode really, really highlights that. I mean, other episodes do as well, but this one does jump out as, you know, he says, well, you know, what about the main council? And, you know, and Vedic says, you know, oh no, they've basically said, you know, I'm a crackpot, but, you know, I'm telling you, this is going to happen. And it's like, oh, well, Okay, so there are different things at play. So I think that's an important point to go on.
You know, and what's interesting about that is that as you go along, you start thinking maybe this guy is a crackpot, right? Because right. he has latched on to Trichor's third prophecy about the three vipers and the Sword of Stars and it prying open the wormhole, the celestial temple, I should say. And at the end, though, it is really interesting, the end of this, after the events do play out, how you can interpret it as being true. And I think it's interesting to highlight how prophecies and ancient texts can be interpreted in different ways. And, you know, Sisko makes a comment about it's all about how you interpret these ancient texts. And he could be talking about a number of books. He could, of course, be talking about the Bible and the stories of the Bible, but he could also be talking about something like the texts of Nostradamus, which people like to point to as foretelling the future. And especially with Nostradamus, you know, the Bajoran prophecies seem to be much more based on things like Nostradamus, the way they're written. Yeah. If you go through the series and you find the ones that they actually explain, they're really, really couched in riddles and imagery that could be interpreted in many different ways.
Well, I think that's what I loved about how Kira tried to explain to Sisko something that he could understand, because Sisko was wrestling with it on the Defiant. And he said that I need something that I can understand. I don't understand, and I can't really get behind being the emissary because I'm not really embracing prophecy. I'm not really embracing that I'm supposed to be this mythical figure that's supposed to understand what these texts mean, what these interpretations mean. I need something that's real. I need something that's factual. I need something that's Starfleet. And I loved it when he said that, because he thinks a certain way. He has a very direct way of understanding and breaking down information so that it benefits Starfleet, because he's an officer of Starfleet.
Yeah.
So when Kira said that, well, the orbs are all these different types of powers and abilities, one of which can manipulate time or can manipulate interdimensional time travel or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you have this, and you have, well, what if the prophets were able to bend time in such a way to give all this information to people in the past to inform their future, and then that becomes the text? Because that, now we're dealing with time travel, which is always replete in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And now Sisko's like, that makes sense. Because now he can wrap his brain around something that's, something that Starfleet is used to seeing.
I don't know if he completely buys into it, but it does give him an opening, right, to see. But when Kira says, to me, that reasoning sounds concrete, solid. I'd even call it Starfleet. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't know if I'd call it Starfleet, but like you said, Norm, you're dealing with time travel. You're dealing with powerful aliens now. You know, that is something that Starfleet officers have encountered time and time again, and so it would not be out of the realm of possibility for them to say, okay, I guess that makes an odd but reasonable scientific explanation that I could work with.
Well, it's not faith based anymore,
right?
It's more scientific based, but very loosely. But again, it's something that he feels that he can reach out with his mind and grasp and understand and explain away, as opposed to dusty texts and prophecies.
But he follows that up and he says, I'm sorry, but where you see a Sword of Stars, I see a comet. Where you see vipers, I see three scientists. And where you see the emissary, I see a Starfleet officer. Mm-hmm. But what do you think, John, at that point, even though he's saying that to Kira, do you feel like it's going off in his mind? Like maybe there's something to this?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's... I definitely think that, you know, I think that, Norm, you have a point that, and I mean, both of you have a point that, you know, the combination of basically holding up science as this sort of lens of, you know, this is just how the prophets did what they did. And so here's how you would explain it in a scientific fashion. Whereas the people that they went to in the past would have said, oh, they gave us a vision of the future and stuff like that. I think that yes, he is starting to blend things together in his mind to understand that the metaphors in which these prophets spoke were necessary. Like I always look at it as, and take this for, you know, for what it is, but let's take, for instance, the story of the creation in Genesis, where you can say, well, it wasn't 6 days, you know, it was X number mm-hmm. of years and all of these yeah. sorts of things. But then you could go to somebody like Cisco who would, you know, say something like that. And you could say, yes, but this is an explanation given to a people who hadn't yet gone to the stars, who hadn't yet done the all of these complex sorts of things that would have given them a better understanding of the planet, much less their relation in the globe. So it's really just a broken down parable so that these people in this moment in time can understand it, and then they will build off of that. So I think that, yes, he's starting to see how the two worlds aren't mutually exclusive, but can coincide and coexist mm-hmm. and inform each other.
It's interesting what you say about creation and 6 days, because for me personally, when I was young, that's how I tried to wrap my mind around it, because I very quickly said, this doesn't make any sense. You know, no one created the world in 6 days. So if it's going to actually be something that I can try to believe in, I have to think that a day represents some other period of time, whether it's hundreds or thousands of years or however long, that's what's being said there. So I guess in a sense, I didn't think about it until you said that now, that maybe what was going on in my mind is a little bit of what's going on in Cisco's mind here. And finally, we get to the point where Dax, I love the conversation that he has with Dax, because he's starting to drift towards this. And she asks him, you mean some of the prophecies have come true? And he says, if you interpret them a certain way, yes. And then in figuring out what to do, she tells him, what would you do if there was no prophecy? You know, if you'd never heard of Trakor's prophecy, what would you do? And he says, I'd continue working on the communications relay. Then it seems to me you have a choice. You can either make your decisions or you can let the prophecies make them for you. And that is so pivotal too. And I talked about earlier, leading up to Rapture and what happens later, he drifts towards the latter, right? Letting prophecies make choices for him, I think, is really where he ends up by the end of the series.
Well, I think it's interesting that we haven't talked about Cisco's faith in himself. We're talking about the faith that they're putting into this prophecy, and we're talking about the faith that hopefully everything works out all right. And we're talking about all of this, all of these different external forces that are working against this project. But in the end, I agree with you. I think that conversation that Dax had with Cisco was more a conversation of testing Cisco's own faith in himself as an officer, because he has all of these different factors that are pulling him in all these different directions. He has the responsibility to Starfleet to have this array work. He has the responsibility to the Bajoran people to represent their interests as the emissary. He also has this responsibility to Starfleet to make sure that this project works as a peaceful coexistence between the now newly formed treaty between the Cardassians and the Federation and the Bajorans. So he's serving all these different masters throughout the course of the show, and Dax, and I think Terry Farrell just does this so well, she brings this great calm into the scene and really boils it down to two very basic points. Do you believe in everyone else, or do you believe in yourself? Mm-hmm. And that was very akin to when, in Best of Both Worlds, when Guinan said, you are ready for the chair. All you have to do, when she's referencing Riker, all you have to do is believe in yourself. You have everything that you need to make this decision, except the one thing that's missing from you is faith in your ability to make that decision. And I think this is where that crossover that, John, you were talking about, where this merging of all these different ideals is starting to become more comfortable with Cisco, because now he's like, okay, I understand this part of being the emissary. I understand my role in Starfleet. I understand my responsibility at this time. And now I am ready to make this decision, because now I know that this is all a balancing act of how to maintain everyone's expectations of what they think of me versus what I think I should give them.
I think this is the beginning of the balancing act, though, because it's easy for Dax to pull him back to the Starfleet side at this point, because at this point, he still hasn't bought into the idea that he's the emissary in the first place. His identity is that he's a Starfleet commander. And so I think he has strong faith in himself and his ability to be a Starfleet commander, but people keep planting these seeds in his mind that maybe I'm more than that. Maybe I am this religious figure. Maybe I am this emissary, even though at this point he still doesn't want to be that. And so this prophecy is really making him question that a lot. And as we move on, then the balancing act that you talk about really kicks in. Once he really believes he's the emissary, but he's also got Starfleet wanting to make sure that he upholds the mission that he was sent there for and eventually leads the fight in the war, then he really, really has to balance.
But again, with being so different from what you expect from a Star Trek episode, what I love about Deep Space Nine, as I continue to watch more and more and more episodes again, are these shades of gray. Are these different levels of...
Now, you're not saying that you love Shades of Grey, the episode, right?
I'm sorry to even admit this, but I don't even know that the episode existed, so okay. I'll watch it
pretending you don't know.
That's my agenda. But no, it's neat because it's... When you're watching the original series or Next Generation or even Enterprise, a Starfleet officer has a very singular purpose. To explore and to maintain the responsibilities of what the Federation needs to do for all of its citizens. But Deep Space Nine, much like Babylon 5, it's a really different animal here because Sisko has to deal with a lot of personalities that aren't Starfleet. He knows how to deal with Starfleet. He knows how to deal with Starfleet politics. He knows how to run a ship. He knows how to run a crew. And all of those people have to snap too because he has the three command pips. But that's not everybody that comes to Deep Space Nine or Tarek Noir. He has to be able to essentially become a manager of so many different personalities and so many different races and beliefs and credos that it's neat to see that tested on that type of a personality, because Avery Brooks has that behind his eyes to juggle all those different experiences and all those different external forces that really, I think, are the building blocks of such a great character.
I agree. I want to go back though to the idea that Dax saying to him, what would you do if you removed all of these external forces? And I think that the point that it gets to at the end of the episode is maybe also informed by the idea that he feels the prophecies, maybe this is a reach, but he could reason out that the prophecies are speaking to and about him because he did make his own decisions and it still led to, depending on your point of view, the prophecy coming true. Yeah. So he comes to a point of viewing himself as a piece of this larger tapestry. And it's not, I know that feels a little bit, that statement feels a little bit out of focus with what we've been saying for the last couple of minutes, but sort of that sense of by coming into myself, I am also becoming a part of something larger. Just like being a Starfleet officer, you're a part of the Federate, you're acting with your own instincts and training, but it is within the larger tapestry of the Federation itself.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's out of line really, because this episode is a journey for him. I mean, the whole series is a journey for him, but this episode is a transitional period. And because he took the actions that he took to guide those three comet fragments through the wormhole, which turn out to be, by the interpretation that Kira gives, the Vipers. The Vipers weren't the Cardassians, they were the comet fragments. then he can see that, yeah, maybe he was put there in that position so that he could carry out those actions. So maybe the prophets are guiding them, and therefore maybe the prophecy is true. But again, though, it's so subjective, right? I mean, they're interpreting the prophecy to mean one thing, and then after something happens, then they're reinterpreting the prophecy. And in either case, they would have thought that it came true.
But are they reinterpreting it? Does it get back to the idea of what we were talking about with the different points of view of the prophecy comes true, but they don't understand the implications of what it's telling them?
Okay.
You know, like Vedic Yarga is, it does come true, but he doesn't have, he might break down Kira for not understanding the texts, but you find out that it's really, he doesn't understand the texts.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe Kira and Sisko understand the texts better than the Vedic.
Heart of a child, right? You have to have the faith of a child, as some faiths have said.
Well, when you look back at it, that makes perfect sense, right? Because if Sisko actually is half prophet in the first place, he would have an innate understanding. Maybe he doesn't realize it, but somewhere within him, maybe he has an innate understanding of these events and prophecies.
Right.
But then again, it's easy to, like, say in Kira's case, it's easier to reinterpret it after the fact. It's not so much, I mean, because she,
right.
What if there were, I mean, you know, just to play devil's advocate here, what if the comet broke into four pieces? Then the Cardassian Vipers would still be three.
True.
So she wouldn't be able to make that, she wouldn't be able to reinform herself based on the coincidence that the comet was cracked into three pieces.
Well, you could also claim that the shuttle pod is a fourth piece coming through.
No, it's true. And it's, again, it's, I think it's, I think that part of the writing was more to inform Kira that, yes, she is wrestling also with this position of being this officer and then also being a representative for her people spiritually. So as much as we've been focusing on Sisko and his responsibilities, Kira also has as strong of a responsibility because her faith is always continually challenged, and she has to put up this wall. I like the bit of writing where she says that I have to maintain this level of my personality and my profession over being a spiritual person.
Yeah.
And I think that obviously it was called out because the Vedic said that you're obviously not studying the text the way you should.
Yeah.
But she says, I have this in my life. I have this responsibility. I have to help the emissary work this station. Before reading the texts.
Yeah, which is something that I think Kira does well all the way through the series. That she always upholds her duty, pretty much always upholds her duty as an officer before she lets her faith interfere. One thing that was not in the prophecy was the part about where one of the Vipers seduces the Irishman.
getting back to my earlier point. Come on. He's an Irishman.
It's the smile. It's smiley.
Absolutely. Well, one more thing here before we start wrapping up that I was curious about. And Norm, this may be a great question for you because you're not as deep into DS9 as John and I are. There's this debate between viewpoints. Odo has a great segment in this episode where he talks about agendas and viewpoints. But if we go back to the end of season one within the hands of the prophets, where we have Keiko and Wynn having this debate and dispute about the interpretation of the prophets in the wormhole and the fact that the view of Starfleet and the Federation is that it's a scientific explanation, but for the Bajorans, it's actually a religious one, and that's their celestial temple. And I'm just curious as a viewer how the viewpoints of each viewer may influence how they interpret the overall story of DS9. Because when you look here, you can take the events that happen with the comet and with the communications relay from a purely scientific and engineering standpoint, or you can take it as a matter of faith and a prophecy come true, as Vedic Yarka obviously is and Jadzia is not, because I see them as being the extremes of these viewpoints. And then Kira and Sisko in the middle, who Kira is kind of on board the whole time, Sisko's not, but then he comes around at the end. So how does your individual viewpoint and your individual agenda color how you interpret DS9?
That's a really, really interesting question. And I think this plays to the strength of this particular episode. As fans, we always know that there's a gear shift in a season and when everything kind of gels together. And when I've watched the first season, and it was very vanilla Star Trek for me.
Yeah, I call it TNG because, light, actually.
Right, because it was a bridge between, yeah, you know, what happened in at the end of TNG or during that time simultaneously. So you're dealing with a lot of sure footing when it comes to Starfleet storytelling. But when it came to this particular episode, I was like, almost every act, I started shifting my position because it was A, watching one particular character's opinion change, and the writing was so good because, again, Sisko was very firm in his belief at the very beginning, and then he started to shift a little bit towards the middle, and then he started talking with the Vedic at the end. I didn't expect that. I thought he would wrestle with it a little bit more personally at the end in his ready room, or say with Kira or Dax, not with the Vedic himself, saying like, tell me a little bit more about these prophecies. I need to know these things because obviously I'm starting to believe that these things are coming true.
Yeah.
In one form or another. So it really depends on, I've always felt that Star Trek was doing its job when you as the viewer were being able to get into the character's viewpoint of the character that's being focused on in the episode at that time, whether it was Kira wrestling with it or whether it was Dax coming in and being this calm and this really cool mentor to Sisko, as she always was, or as Curzon always was, or Sisko himself at the end, you know, just piloting that starship and or piloting the shuttle and saying like, my belief is getting me through this. Kira is getting me through this. And both of those opinions are kind of like informing me as the viewer, like something's changing. These characters are growing. And it's nice to see that without kind of like the experience of being a seasoned veteran, because I don't know where my opinion is going to go because I don't know the series, you know, from this point in season 3 on forward as well as you guys do. So every single scene is giving me something new to watch, and it's really entertaining. I think the writing is just so good.
I think we can definitely all agree that that this is a scientific moment. Objectively, we can all agree on that.
That's right. And Norm, I think what you said about Sisko talking to the Vedic at the end, I think that highlights what John said early on, where this is the point where the writers have gone all in with, this is where we're going to go with this story moving forward, that Sisko is going to begin to get more involved in his role as the emissary with the religion and prophecies and Bajoran religion are going to play a much bigger part in the storytelling.
And that's the one thing, again, in Deep Space Nine that I was a little caught off guard by, was how strong they went in that direction versus how it may have been summed up or cut short a little bit in a Next Generation episode, where they wouldn't continue that storytelling, where they were trying to wrap it up a little bit or maybe reference it on like at a season or two later. But you're right. Faith in Star Trek is an interesting thing, because I think that this series, and forgive me if I'm speaking out of turn, I think this series probably dealt the strongest with that force, with the Bajorans and with the orbs and with Kai Winn and her agenda, because I know what happens in the end. But it's really a huge part of the tapestry of the storytelling. I mean, regardless of the Dominion War and regardless of all of that, this giant operatic space battle, there's still that really nice undercurrent of what's happening religiously in the storytelling.
Well, DS9 goes very mythological starting around here, but not full on from here, but you see the seeds being planted. But as it plays out in the end, I mean, they really, really go on a mythological path more so than Star Trek normally does. So you definitely see that. All right. Well, let's get into our final thoughts and our ratings here. So, John, how about you? What are your final thoughts here on the episode?
I think that it is a it's a key episode. I think that much like the bulk of season three, this is really an indication that the writers and producers have found their footing and they know where they're going to go, how they're going to proceed with things. It might not immediately come to fruition, but this is where the journey begins in a lot of senses. And so with that, I will give it 8.5 spoiled bottles of Kanar out of 10.
Very good. You know, that is something that we talked about on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Which we haven't mentioned yet here. It's in passing, and you have to really be paying attention to what actually happened. But apparently, Quark tested the Kanar on Morn and made him sick.
Which, considering what we later find out Morn is carrying in one of his stomachs, is an amazing feat.
Yeah, and this Kanar must have been really bad because they said they didn't think anything could make Morn sick, and yet he got food poisoning from that. All right, well, how about you, Norm? What are your final thoughts and your rating?
Well, this was a surprise to me because, again, it was a type of Star Trek that I'm not usually used to seeing and watching. I think Deep Space Nine is something that I need to delve in a little bit more. But I think it's everything that I've seen so far, at least trying to remember it from my first viewing, it's a fantastic show. And I think that this episode, I felt as a newer observer, was clicking. Everything started to click. And that happens, during the course of, and this was season three, right? So usually things happen in season three, things start to gel and start to take on that second win. So I think that's fantastic. And I would rate this, because I was so surprised and I got so into it, I will rate this 3 out of 3 Vipers.
Oh, nice. Excellent. Very good. Well, yeah, this is an episode that I enjoy because of the story. It's kind of a slow episode, I would say. Maybe DS9 does have its slow moments like this. I think compared to some TNG episodes, it's sort of slow moving. Although we still get a lot of TNG filling episodes even here in season three. We've got things like, Heart of Stone, which is right around this, and of course Defiant with Thomas Riker coming on board, and even Fascination feels very TNG-ish. But I still like the episode because it's one of those that, as I mentioned earlier, is easily forgotten. It kind of gets lost in the shuffle of all the other episodes. And there are a number of those in DS9. And in many cases, those are the episodes that are the pivotal moments in the overall arc. And then you kind of forget where certain long-running story elements got started. And I think this is the one, the key one, with Sisko and the prophecies here. So I'm going to give this episode 7 unintentional romantic passes at a Cardassian.
That's an awful lot.
Well, Norm, thanks for joining us today. So before we let everyone go, tell people where they can find you on the network and around the internets.
Well, you can always find me on Twitter and Facebook, Norman Lau. That's NORMANLAO. And I'm an associate producer for 4 shows here on the network: The 602 Club, Warp 5, The Orb, and Star Trek Axanar, the official Axanar podcast. But I'm also a sponsor for the show through patreon.com. And it's a huge opportunity because it allows me to help fund all the fantastic things that are done on this network. So that's patreon.com/TrekFM. That's where I found it. That's where you can find it too.
Awesome. Thanks for plucking Patreon there for us, Norm. But you're right, it's very important because that's what helps us keep the shows coming to everyone. So I hope everyone will join you in supporting us there. But you mentioned you're an associate producer of Warp 5. You didn't mention that you're the host of Warp 5 now.
I am, and it's a fantastic opportunity, and I wanted to thank Christopher for this. I thanked him on an upcoming show, and it's a huge opportunity for me because I love talking Star Trek. It's something that all of us and all of the listeners love to do because we're very passionate about it. And I just hope that I can keep the decon chamber
well supplied,
well supplied with gel as Flock. No, but thank you from the bottom of my heart, and thank you all the fans for supporting me through all of this. And great stuff is coming up, so stay tuned. Thanks.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks again, Norm, for joining us today.
It's been fun talking about Deep Space Nine today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And so I was biased against it. And even when I started buying the two-disc collector's edition DVDs, I avoided buying any of the even-numbered movies.
Odd-numbered movies.
Earl Grey.
Like they stated in the end of the movie, you know, they thought he'd outlive all of them. And I'm like, yeah, that's what should have happened. We should have seen Data, like, in the, you know, 26th century, like, Data 5.0, whatever we call him.
To the journey!
You don't know if she's going to stab him or smooch him.
She's going to smooch him, of course. After dessert.
After dessert.
We all know what dessert means.
Warp 5.
Along with technology and along with trying to study the origins of a lot of different things that we've come to know in the original series and beyond, it's hard to try and deconstruct it without insulting what has come in all of the things that we know of being Vulcan mind meld.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
And my thought was, in the next scene, Crusher should have the body of the dead Klingon sitting on the back of her toilet holding a candle. You know, which she would only get to do after Lieutenant Yara's gotten to hold the dead Klingon up to her ear to see if she can hear the ocean.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Everything you would imagine would be in an opening title sequence for this show is in there. I think the shot that really does it for me, the shot that really pulls everything together, is when he dunks the basketball.
Melodic Treks.
So we do know an awful lot of people get associated with Vic Fontaine. He name drops to the nth degree about all the famous people that he hung around with. One of whom is Frank Sinatra.
Axanar, the official podcast.
When there's a possibility for something to be misunderstood or not clearly explained, it can potentially open up a big hole for a show, because people can end up going down a path that was actually not what somebody wanted to be done.
The 602 Club.
What are those Bond movies that you go back to time and time again because they just do it better?
First of all, Matthew, nobody does it better.
That's true.
It makes me feel sad for the rest.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, we're on iTunes. We're also on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. You can go to the website. You can stream the show from there. You can download the MP3 file. And while you're out there getting the shows, especially on iTunes and Stitcher, if you have a free moment, leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear what you think about the show, and those also help other Star Trek fans find the Ready Room, because in iTunes, those affect how you place in search results. Ratings, written reviews, and lifetime subscriptions are the way for people to find the show. So also, if you stream the show from iTunes and you're not subscribed, go ahead and hit the subscribe button. That way you'll get the show the moment that I publish it, and that'll help us rise up in the search results as well. Now, John, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, and as you know, because we've talked behind the scenes, a lot of big changes have happened in my life over the past 3 weeks, and it actually happened right after I published the last episode of The Ready Room, episode 166, and our listeners who are members of our listeners group on Facebook, the Babel Conference, they know all the details because we've explained everything that's going on there. But for those of you who aren't a member of that group, first of all, if you're on Facebook, come over and join. But I do want to tell you what's going on. So, you know, for a number of years now, for many years, I have worked from my home studio doing client work. And for the past 4 years, as I've been building Trek FM, that's what I've been doing. And it made it very easy for me to work Trek FM into my workflow and host all the shows that I host and produce these and get them out to you. But I've had to make a change, and instead of doing client work, I've actually taken a job as the managing editor of Metropolis, which is a long-running City Life magazine here in Tokyo. And as a result, I'm not in the studio anymore. I actually have a 4-hour commute every single day, Monday through Friday, I spend all my time in the office there at the magazine, so I really cannot podcast the way that I used to. I'm going to continue doing two shows, this one and The Orb, with Matthew Rushing. And otherwise, the other shows will continue with different hosts. Matthew will continue to do Literary Treks, along with Dan Gunther of Trek Lit Reviews. They've already put out their first episode. And Norm, who was just on the show with us here, is the new host of Warp 5. Now, Norm had become my co-host already for the past four episodes, but he has now taken over Warp 5. And Axanar will continue. I'll probably continue producing that show, but I won't be hosting. And so everything is moving along, and the network isn't going anywhere, and this show isn't going anywhere. But there will be some changes. The Ready Room will be shorter, as this one is, and the frequency might change a little bit. I'm not sure about that yet. I'm going to hopefully keep doing it weekly, but I have to see how things play out there. So I wanted to let everyone know what was going on and why there was no Ready Room since the middle of November. But now we're getting back on track, and I hope you'll keep listening, and I hope you'll keep supporting the network. So, John, if people want to find you elsewhere on the network, you mentioned a little bit in news that you're the new co-host, the third co-host there on Commentary Trek Stars, but you've got your own podcast off the network as well, and you do all sorts of other things. So tell us where we can find you.
Well, you can find me crawling around on Twitter at Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE, on the aforementioned Commentary Trek Stars. And once a week with my buddy Craig on Words with Nerds, which is a podcast talking about various topics that you find on the usual channels like iTunes and Stitcher and such.
Awesome. Great. Well, if you want to find me, you can find me. I'm not doing as many shows as I used to, so you can find me on this show and also on The Orb with Matthew Rushing. And if you go back to past episodes, you can find me on Literary Treks and Warp 5 and Continuing Mission, Hyperchannel, Axanar, which I was co-hosting with Alec Peters. And so I'm all over the place if you want to hear me, some of my thoughts on Star Trek from the past. And moving forward, again, it'll be The Ready Room and The Orb. Now, if you'd like to share your thoughts on today's show, we would love to hear from you. You can join us in the Babel Conference on Facebook if you're a Facebook user. The way you get there is to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Or on our website, click Discussion up on the menu bar. Those will both take you right over there. It is a closed group, so you do need to click Join, but I'll let you right on in. And we're having great discussions over there about Star Trek. We have hundreds of members there. It's a really great place. Now, if you're not on Facebook, you can also contact us in other places. You can send us a message by going to our website at trek.fm/contact. Use the form there, choose to send to a show, and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to me by email. You'll also find us on Twitter, where our username is trekfm. And if you go to speakpipe.com/trekfm, you'll be able to send us a voicemail just using the microphone on your webcam, your smartphone, or your tablet. And you can upload it to us right there from the page as an MP3 file. One other way that you can help out the network is, as Norm mentioned at the end of the feature there, you can support us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you can set an amount that you would like to contribute to the network each month. We are bringing you Star Trek podcasts as a listener-supported network, so we hope that you will help us out there if you can. Every little bit makes a difference, and it's more important than ever right now for listeners to help us out and make sure that we can keep bringing great Star Trek talk to you every single week. So we really thank all of you who are supporting us there through Patreon right now and everyone who will support us in the future. And we also want to thank our associate producer here on The Ready Room, Renee Roberts. You can find Renee on Twitter at Mares_1701. And she's been a great supporter of the network from the very beginning, going all the way back to 4 years ago when we started this. So we really thank Renee for that.
Yay, thank you.
All right, John. Well, I am going to head down to the infirmary and make sure that Morn is okay.
Well, then, I think it's time to stick some Cardassian vipers in it because the Ready Room is done.